So welcome to our first intermediate class in mindfulness. And we'll find out together what that is. As far as I know, it's never been taught before. I haven't taught it before. And I've never seen any models of how to teach it before. However, as many of you know, I've been enjoying many years of teaching the introductory course in mindfulness. And the more I've actually taught that course, the more I've enjoyed doing it. And I've enjoyed a lot the repetition for myself over year after year, kind of exploring the same material and seeing how to little bit try to tweak it or understand it better or to express it better, what the teachings are. And now that we're at the center, I thought the opportunity was here was to try to develop some similar kind of courses that would allow me, partly, to do the same thing with other material, to kind of go with a little bit more depth with the practice with people. And if there's any degree of success in doing this course, then I see kind of this something that develops over the years. You do it over and over again. And I know some of you here in the room did a lot of the, came back over and over again to the introductory course that I taught on Thursdays. And sometimes I didn't know whether that was a good sign if you came back. I also feel that there's a lot of people in our meditation community who have done a lot of practice and are looking for ways to then continue to deepen their practice and to explore the teachings and the practice in new ways, new perspectives. One of the reasons to do a course like this for me is that it's a lot easier for me to repeat myself if I'm teaching a course. So like the intro class, I say more or less the same thing, you know, three times a year, right? You come and you kind of know the routine. Some of you come a lot and you kind of know more or less what I'm going to say. And I feel completely embarrassed, whatever, about repeating myself in that context, because everybody understands this is an intro class. But on Monday nights or Sunday morning, if I said something in 1999, I'm actually reluctant to say it over again, because I know it's silly, but I feel like if there's like one person in the room who's heard what I had to say before, like some particular talk or topic or some way of saying something, I feel a little bit odd, like I'm repeating myself to someone. And you don't do that in polite company. But if I call it an intermediate class, then I can say you do the same thing, right, over and over over the years. And I don't have to be embarrassed. And that way I can cover the material that I think is important to cover on a regular basis. That's all, maybe has a lot to do with my shortcomings. But I'm hoping we have a good time here. I'm hoping that you enjoy your mindfulness meditation and that we'll share in that enjoyment and exploration here in these 4 weeks. The idea for this course is that there is a kind of prerequisite. I think this class works a lot better. It will work a lot better if you have the background in mindfulness practice already. So have you done at least the intro class that I've taught or some equivalent of that by another teacher, or if you've gone to a 10-day retreat, that's probably equivalent enough. And the kind of material covered in the intro class is kind of assumed as part of this intermediate class. Some of you, I'm quite confident, will hear things that you've heard from me before, and will hear things that you've heard many times by me or other teachers. And some of you, I think, could actually give some of the classes I'm going to be leading in this series. And I'm completely unembarrassed about that, because this is an intermediate class, and maybe some of you are more advanced than intermediate, and I don't know why you're here. But this is the nature of the class. So I'll cover some. Still, it's covering some basic basic aspects of the practice. Some of the stuff which is not a surprise to many of you. There's a requirement in taking the class, and the requirement. I'll wait until there's one more person coming before I really make sure everybody's on board. Yes.
Can I say something, Bill? You recently gave a talk on the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
And as you began the talk, I said, oh, good. Here comes Gil's talk on the Four Noble Truths. I've read this at least twice before. And as you went through it, whether you said it differently or whether I heard it differently, it was different. So each repetition, for me, is a good repetition.
Yeah.
Because there's always something.
Yeah, thank you. It's very reassuring for me to hear that, of course. And I should probably hear that and then overcome my reluctance to repeat myself.
Yes.
But... So sometimes I think it'd be really great to, you know, move to Grants Forth, North Dakota, where no one's ever heard me before. And then probably I could, you know, talk for, you know, 6 months or a year with, you know, say a lot of the same stuff over again, and it's all new for them. And so anyway, welcome everyone, and I'm happy to be here with all of you. So the requirement for the course is that you're required to be in the course within reason. You know, if something happens that's, you know, prevents it, it's okay. But your requirement is that you to sit every day for 45 minutes for these 4 weeks. And what that means, the way the calendar works actually, is that we actually meet. That means 4 weeks means 4 times 7 is 28 days. 28 days of sitting 45 minutes a day. Because if you just ended that on the fourth class meeting, you'd actually only get 21 days. You understand that? Right? So your, you know, honor system that you'll continue. 28 days. And so 45 minutes a day. And for the concentration class that we taught in the springtime, the idea was you could do 45 minutes, break it up, you know, two different sittings or something. You didn't have to do it all at once. That would be okay with me. I would like to ask you to, if you really try to stretch yourself and try to make it 45 minutes one time. So really kind of one big block of sitting 45 minutes. And to do that every day. The other thing that you're expected to do, required to do, is to keep a kind of a journal of your sittings. And I'll talk more about that, and they'll change the instructions in the course of the class. And that means maybe you have to kind of count on giving an extra 10, 15 minutes. I don't know how long it takes you to write at the end of each sitting to be able to jot down some very simple notes about what that sitting was like, the experience of it. And for today, I have actually some things to pass out, kind of a form that you will fill out at the end of your sittings for the next week. And so that's the requirements of the class. And one of the reasons that I'll say it this way, one of the central teachings of the Buddha is the notion of skillful means. Upaya kusala, kusala upaya. And or some people translate it skill in means, which maybe makes a little bit more sense. It's having certain skill in certain means, certain ways of practicing, certain practices, certain techniques. And that part of what we're doing in Buddhist practice, traditionally, in the teachings of the Buddha, is cultivating and developing a skill. And I think a lot of Western meditation practitioners don't think of what they're doing as so much as in light of developing a skill as they do thinking that they're trying to have certain kinds of experiences. Trying to get calm or blissful or, you know, insightful or have something happen, some experience. The Buddha actually wasn't that interested in experience to the degree to which many Westerners are. He was more interested in meditation as a form of cultivation, cultivating parts of ourselves, developing certain capacities that we have, and developing certain skills in learning how to live in a wise way. And so a skill is learned by repetition. A skill is learned by learning a technique or a way of being or some principle, and then applying it and learning how to apply it in our lives. Meditation and mindfulness in daily life is kind of like playing the piano. No two people will play the piano the same way. There's an infinite number of ways to play the piano. There's an infinite number of ways, I suppose, to be a human being and be in the world. And you're not expected to be exactly different. What you expect to do is to let the mindfulness practice be a way to help give you the skills to help you explore and understand and see deeply into the life that you have. And I say that it's a very important point, because many people will come to Buddhism, come to a spiritual practice, come to and assume that they have to be different. That somehow so there's some kind of way in which they have to kind of impose certain, they have to be, you know, something. And I would like to suggest that a lot of what we're trying to do is to develop the skills to see clearly who we are. To see clearly. Not the skill in how to kind of manufacture ourselves in a different way. The two different things are not so separate from each other, of course. But the idea is we're developing skills in how to see ourselves in a very deep way. And it becomes kind of a playground then. It's like you sit down and you tune in with curiosity, with investigation, with interest, with playfulness. What is here in this world right now? What's here in this body, in this mind, in this heart? And you start tuning in, finding out what that's like. So the Buddha talked a lot about developing skills, a skill set for doing this. Now, in the introductory course, I believe that I teach, I believe the primary, one of the primary messages I'm trying to get across is that mindfulness involves non-reactive awareness. Just seeing things as they are. Not being for things or against things, not pushing things away, not holding on to anything. Just learning how to clearly see things as they actually are. I think it's very profound practice to do that. It's a very powerful thing, because so much of our life is built up around non-acceptance, holding on or pushing away or judging or criticizing or evaluating some way. And just simply cultivating ability to see and letting things be as they actually are can be radically transformative, I think, as many of you have experienced. But however, there's more to Buddhist spirituality than simply allowing things to be and seeing clearly what's there. There's also developing ourselves, developing certain capacities to see more clearly, to see with greater intensity, to see with greater in different kind of ways. And so part of what we're doing in practice is also cultivating and developing these capacities. Now, these two aspects have to be held together. The aspect of leaving everything alone and seeing clearly, not manipulating, not trying to control, accepting things in an unconditional way, versus the practice of cultivating and developing ourselves. They don't have to be seen in opposition to each other, but there's a way of holding them together, or holding them together as a collection of practices. One skill that we're developing is the skill to leave things alone and see very clearly what they are. That is non-reactive awareness. That's a skill that we developed. There are other skills. There's skills of developing concentration. There's skills of developing rapture and joy. There are skills in developing equanimity. There are skills in developing investigation and studying and looking more clearly. There are skills in developing our capacity for loving kindness. There's all these skills that we can develop. And then in different contexts in our lives, these different skills will be important to apply. When you have a wide skill set, a wide variety of practices to fall back on, to use, the negative can be that you're confused about what to do. And you're wondering, kind of searching around for what to do, and you're not quite sure, and doubt arises, and you try one thing for a little while, and then, well, that doesn't work, and you try something else for a little while, and that doesn't work, and try something else for a little while, and before you know it, you're snacking out of your refrigerator. Because it's just, you know, you're not getting anywhere with anything. And if you have just one practice, it's easier than sometimes, because there's no choices to be made, and you can actually develop greater depth. The benefit of having a wide variety of skills or practices is that you can use them in different situations where they're most useful. And life is quite varied. And it's quite valuable to have different things to bring to bear, different ways of being mindful in different situations. So, for example, there are some situations where I find it very valuable to practice mindfulness in my body. Some situations where I find it more valuable to practice mindfulness of my emotions. Other situations I find it more valuable to practice mindfulness of my thoughts. other situations where I find it more valuable to cultivate loving kindness or to work on compassion or equanimity. Other times where my mindfulness practice, my ability to be mindful focuses primarily on looking at clinging and the possibility of non-clinging. So I choose different parts of my experience to focus on depending on what is most skillful in any given time. What is most skillful in any given time depends a lot upon the purpose you're doing it, or the direction you're trying to go, where you're trying to go with your practice. Doesn't that make sense? Skill usually, you know. So one of the questions we should all be asking ourselves is, for what purpose are we doing our practice? Some people do the practice kind of because they've heard it's a good idea and they do it out of faith and without much thought. But I think it's actually now, for that intermediate level, that it's very valuable and important to look at what is the purpose that you're doing the practice for, and to investigate that in a very deep way. And each of you will have a different reason for why you're doing it, the purpose that you're doing it. But if you have a sense of purpose, then you can have a better sense of what skill you want to apply and how to develop it. And you can also have a greater sense of resolve resolve in applying and getting the job done, going towards that purpose. Now, one of the purposes to practice, of course, is to sit without any purpose, which some Buddhist teachers will say. So then what's the most skillful, useful way of developing that? Well, maybe then just pure vipassana practice, just seeing things as they are without trying to change anything, is the way to discover how to have no purpose. Perhaps the purpose is to develop greater independence or non-attachment. And what's most helpful for that? Well, perhaps what's most helpful for that is to develop a deep state of calm, concentration, so that from that basis of calm, you can see more clearly the nature of your attachment. I spent some time recently being a little bit agitated, and I couldn't see my attachments very well. But as soon as I was able to get out of that situation and calm down a little bit, I could see very clearly where I was holding on, and it became pretty easy, actually in some ways quite joyful to let go. And it was actually quite wonderful, because there's all these sleepless nights I had. And during the sleepless nights, the primary practice was, what did I have to let go of in order to be happy? Not just what to let go of, but, you know, that wasn't good enough. What I had to let go of to be happy. And it was great practice there in the middle of the night, you know. How many times can a newborn poop in his diaper at 2 o'clock in the morning? Oh, here we go again. So what's the purpose for which you're doing the meditation practice? And I'll leave that for you to think about. And perhaps as you spend this next week, that's one of the assignments for the week, is to reflect and write a little bit about what you feel the purpose is, or the purposes for which you use meditation. What are the purposes? What is the purpose for which you use meditation? And try to make this very personal. So in other words, don't go look up in a book for the answer. You know, Jack Kornfield says in Seeking the Heart of Wisdom, the purpose of meditation is, you know, maybe you shouldn't even read any books this week, you know, so you don't make sure you're not polluted with other people's ideas. But, you know, spend some time reflecting on this, and then we'll talk more about purpose next week. So in the introductory course, in a sense, the emphasis has been on learning how to let things be, just seeing clearly how things are without trying to be for or against anything. And some scholars who study Buddhism call that an analytical approach to meditation, because it's just simply, I don't like the word analytical or analysis, but it's simply kind of analyzing actually what's actually here, what's there. There's a simplicity. A sound is a sound, you hear the sound. You feel an itch, you see the itch. In contrast to analytical approach to practice, is something that we call the dynamic or the synthetical approach to practice, understanding the dynamics of what happens in the meditation practice itself. Understanding the meditation is not just simply a whole series of independent, discrete events that you just kind of know now. The meditation itself is a dynamic process. For no other reason, because the mind itself is a dynamic process. The mind in Buddhism is never understood as a thing. It's a heresy in Buddhism to call the mind a thing, like a solid thing, like an unfixed thing. What it is, the mind is understood to be a process. And so we're working with that process in meditation, and meditation itself becomes a process. And so getting a sense of how that process works, the dynamics, some of the different elements that affect that process, is part of what is very helpful in deepening a meditation practice, a mindfulness practice. So the dynamic aspects of practice, and how do we understand that? What do we look for? What do we understand? So with this new baby that has come, someone gave me a book called something like The Scientist in the Crib. And it's about some scientists in Berkeley who have been studying, biologists or something, psychologists, who've been studying newborn babies and seeing how they learn. And I haven't read much of the book, just a few pages. But one of the theses of the book, I have no idea how unique it is to these researchers, but one of the theses is that the reason why human beings have such a long immature period, it's supposed to last until only age 18, and whereas other animals, have very short periods of time or almost none where they spend with their parents learning how to survive and do their thing. And they argued that the argument is that the reason why human beings and beings like human beings take such a long time to be dependent on others and is that if human beings were solely, their way to negotiate their environment was solely based on instinct, as it is like for some animals or instincts, a lot of insects, they would only be able to function in particular environmental niches. You learn a particular way of being as an insect. You learn, you can eat, the only thing you can eat is tomato leaves. So you're a really great tomato leaf eater. But take away tomatoes and you die. You have all the instincts there for tomato eating. So that's just genetically programmed to eat tomato leaves. So you don't have to learn a lot because it's in the genes. But human beings don't have the same level, they have this huge... so if human beings were limited to only one niche, we could have things programmed into our genes, and it can be based on instinct. But it turns out human beings are amazingly adaptable. And they can adapt themselves to all kinds of different niches and environments. And so in order to have that capacity to be so adaptive, we have to have a long period of learning. The mind has to be plastic, has to be malleable. Has to be a mind that can learn to develop new skills, new abilities in different settings. And so the argument of these researchers is the reason why we have this long development period is that we have minds which are not exactly blank slates, but we have minds that in order to survive need to adapt itself and knows how to adapt itself to different environmental and social niches depending on where they find themselves. That makes sense at all? You wonder why I'm saying this, right? What's this have to do with an intermediate course? Why I'm saying this is that the process is two reasons. The process of learning, I think, is really innate in human beings. The curiosity and the interest in to learn. And the other reason I'm saying this is that to appreciate that one of the teachings of Buddhism is that the mind is malleable and plastic. And what we're doing, and this is very, very clearly stated in Buddhism, is that what we're doing in meditation practice is training the mind to come back to its malleable state, its plastic state, as opposed to being fixed and rigid, as our minds can become. And these two things go together, the ability to learn, to be interested, and to have this malleable mind. The mind can be much more easily concentrated when it's malleable and plastic and soft. A mind which is rigid has a very hard time getting concentrated. It's a lot easier to get one-pointed if the mind is soft. And you think maybe if the mind was rigid, it'd be easier to get concentrated. So what I'm hoping as we go through these 4 weeks, that you enter into this period of 45 minutes sitting every day and exploration of mindfulness with a curiosity and interest of investigating. What is your experience like? What's happening with you? What's your experience? What happens to you in meditation practice? Start tracking the changes that go on. Start noticing that when you do certain things, what are the consequences of having done those? So start studying the dynamic aspects of the practice. Does that make some sense, what I'm saying so far? Do you have any questions about this so far?
Yes. Yeah. When you said noticing when you do certain things, what happens?
Yeah.
Does that do certain things, meaning the mind doing certain things while you're meditating?
Sure, yeah.
Can you give one example? I don't understand.
Yeah, you'll become clearer over the weeks as we talk about that. But for example, you sit down and you notice that when you sit down to meditate that your mind is agitated, a lot of thoughts. So you decide what to do with your, what you're going to do is to focus on your breathing. And you notice as you focus on your breathing, the mind gets calmer. There's a change. You did something, and that doing something instituted a change. Or say what you want to practice is non-reactive awareness, where you've been trained, that you're not going to try to make anything different, you're not going to try to change anything, but you're just going to be there very present for that agitated mind. That's what you're going to do. And when you do that, you notice that when you do that, the mind settles, or it gets more agitated or something. You notice that there's a cause and effect relationship there. So one of the things to begin exploring is the cause and effect relationship of what happens, what we do in meditation. I believe that sometimes the idea we get in meditation is that it's a passive event. I don't think passive is a good word for meditation, even though I might have used it many times. We're cultivating a capacity to be receptive. But I don't think of meditation as being passive at all. I think that as we get into it and more involved in it and more engaged, it actually feels very dynamic and active. But the more involved you are, it's a kind of activity that feels effortless. So it's kind of like, you know, riding a bicycle. Is riding a bicycle a passive event? When you first start starting to learn to ride a bicycle, it's a very active event, and it's very difficult, and you're very tense, and you're learning, it's a lot of effort. But once you develop a skill of riding the bicycle, it becomes more effortless to ride it. But it's not passive. But it might be receptive to the experience. I don't know if that's the best analogy. So, having said all that, any other questions before we continue? Yes, please.
The daily meditations required. Do you suggest that if we figure out the purpose of our meditation or my meditation, you keep that same purpose every day through the 28 or 30 days? Or do you sometimes you may change purpose on certain days? But what is your purpose.
So the instructions around purpose is simply to explore and write down, jot down the purpose for which you do meditation, or the purposes. There might be different purposes you apply. And what you do in any particular meditation session during this week, it might be for different purposes. And so I'm not holding you fixed to one particular purpose. There can be simultaneous purposes, right? There can be multiple purposes at the same time. And one of the purposes I hope that you engage with during this time is interest in investigating. Learn to learn more what the meditative mind is like, what that inner life is like. What happens to the inner life that's involved in meditation? So I'm a little bit torn between whether we should sit or if I should say more. Okay, let's sit. When in doubt, sit. It's a very good principle. So as we do this meditation, I would like you to keep an eye out, or keep track of the clarity of your mind. Does your mind become clear as the meditation proceeds? Does it become more cloudy, less clear? Clarity means seeing more clearly what's happening, having kind of greater alertness, sensitivity to noticing what's happening in the moment. Clarity means that what you pay attention to kind of stands out a little more strongly or fully. It's not clouded over by a lot of thoughts or ideas or reactions. So track a little bit as we proceed with the guided meditation. The changing nature of your clarity of mind. So begin now in the usual way, which I ask people to begin, by taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. And as you exhale, to relax your body. Then letting your breath return to normal. Bring your attention to your shoulders and feel the effects of breathing in your shoulders. Perhaps you can feel the shoulders rising and falling, expanding or contracting, moving in some way. And if you don't, you can breathe a little bit more deeply until you feel some effect of the breathing in the shoulders. And then as you're feeling your shoulders, being with your shoulders, they're rising and falling, whatever you feel there, notice how easy or difficult it is to keep your mind there in your shoulders. Does your mind keep wanting to drift away? Or is it, can you be content enough just to be with each breath in how it affects the shoulders? Continuing to feel the effects of breathing in your shoulders. In the next two times that you exhale, soften the shoulders, let them relax a little bit. And then having them softened even just a teeny bit, then notice more carefully what are the sensations that you experience in your shoulders as you breathe. Shoulder blades, collarbone area, that whole area there. Breathing in, breathing out. So for the next series of breaths, until you hear otherwise, each time you exhale, let there be a relaxation of your shoulders, your shoulder blade. And each time you exhale, bring a greater alertness to noticing the sensations in your shoulder. Relaxing as you exhale. As you inhale, tuning into your shoulders, with a silent mind. Or kind of like if you're listening really carefully for a sound. It's pretty natural to let the thinking mind become still. Not in a forced way, but by virtue of being so intent on hearing carefully. Relaxing as you exhale. Letting the mind become silent so that you can more clearly feel the sensations, alert as you breathe in. And letting go of the shoulders, bring your attention to that part of your body, your head, your brain, where you do your thinking. If there is a location, kind of a location. And simply feel that area. Maybe you feel some dull pressure or tightness or tension or energy, spaciousness. And then every time you exhale, soften that muscle, soften that thinking mind. And every time you inhale, let there be a silent, still sensing or feeling, tuning in to the sensations which are there, not judging them or feeling they need to be different. And then letting go of that, bring your attention now to your breathing in whatever way you usually attend to your breathing. Feeling the in-breath and the out-breath. And each time you exhale, let there be overall relaxation, softening. And each time you inhale, a quiet alertness, sensitivity to what the sensations of breathing in. And as you stay with your breathing, how easy is it for you to stay with the breathing? What's the degree to which your mind seems to be settled on your breathing, tuning into it, developing greater clarity of the breath? What degree is it the mind so easily wants to slip away into its thoughts and concerns? And remembering to track the degree of clarity that seems present in your awareness. Quiet clarity. Feeling your breathing, breathing in and breathing out. Feeling intimately or closely what an inhalation feels like, an exhalation. There's the breathing, the object of the attention. And then there's attention, the awareness, and all the different elements that can be associated with that. For example, motivation. How motivated are you to stay with the breath, one breath after the other? when things arise, that if thoughts arise, whatever, that take you away from your breathing, how easy is it for you to let go of those things and come back to the breathing? As you stay with each breath, breathing in and out, how would you evaluate the degree of calmness that's present? Are you calm, agitated? Is it calm attention that you bring on the breathing? Anxious attention? Impatient attention? As you stay with your breathing, how concentrated are you on the breathing? How stabilized is the attention on the breath? There are various degrees of stability. Just very matter-of-factly. How is it for you right now? As you feel your breathing, one breath after the other, how much enjoyment do you have in that process of being with the breathing? On a scale of 1 to 10, this is intensely enjoyable, or moderately so, or mildly pleasant. Unpleasant. staying with the breath, one breath after the other, feeling it intimately. Letting there be a quiet alertness, silent presence to feel your breathing in and breathing out. And then over the next couple of minutes or a few minutes, apply a soft apply real energy, dedicated energy, effort to staying with your breath so you don't miss one in-breath or one out-breath. Apply greater effort. Not a single half breath will you miss, breathing in, breathing out. But if you do miss a breath, or even a half breath, the mind wanders away. Take a moment to clearly recognize what is it that's taken your mind away. What is it that's made it difficult for you to continue? So make real effort to stay with the breathing. Mindfulness meditation gives us access to a whole inner world, whole inner ecology of the mind, the heart, of how things are unfolding and moving in the present moment. In order for the meditation to develop, one of the first requirements is that we are willing to try to turn the mind away from all the thoughts about the future and the past, concerns about the world, work and relationships, and whatever it is we're concerned about out there. Let go of all those things, of the world in a sense, and intentionally turn the attention inward to this world of the breath, of the body, of this inner ecology. The inner the world of inner spirituality. And begin taking an interest in the process of what's happening. Take an interest in what's happening in that inner world. And then as you come to the end of the sitting, what is the clarity of your mind now like? Is your mind duller or sharper than it was when you started sitting? More silent or more filled with chatter? Well, that's one of the things I meant to say is that this Wednesday evening when you come to this class doesn't count as a 45-minute sitting. So that don't think, well, I don't have to do my 45-minute sitting on Wednesday because I'll just come to the class and do it then. So the last thing I said is very important. In the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the first kind of elements of instructions that's given for mindfulness practice is for the practitioner to put aside covetousness and grief concerning the world. And how I understand this, there's many ways of understanding it, is that if we want to be involved in the process of meditation, we have to be very clear that meditation is not thinking about what's out there in the world. It's trying to fix our problems out there in the world. Whatever the world... world is anything beyond the present moment and this inner life, this present moment life. And there's such a tremendous momentum in many of our minds to to be glued in the Velcro mind, you know, with our thoughts, our concerns out there, our preoccupations, our, you know, all these different things we're so concerned about, so attached about. And so the mind kind of goes there very quickly. And you need to be very clear when you sit down to meditate that is not what meditation is about. That you're turning your attention away from the concerns of the world, what the world is going on in the world, all those things out there. Now that doesn't mean that you have to exactly stop. Like say what you most desire in the world is what you most desire is a. A nylon sweater, you know. If you have a nylon sweater, then you know you have your life made. People will, you know, praise you. They think you're really cool, and you probably get a promotion at work, and a new partner, and just a nylon sweater. You really do it right. You're caught up in that. So to turn away from the nylon sweater, that concern in the world, if you're really convinced that nylon sweaters is not where meditation practice is going to unfold. It doesn't necessarily, it might not be so easy to let go of the nylon sweater, thinking about it. But meditation is not continuing to think about nylon sweaters. The meditation process is to turn into the inner ecology, the inner world, of what it feels like to be caught up with nylon sweaters. So you're turning attention to be in that inner world, that inner ecology, to explore what is this like to be caught up, concerned about nylon sweaters. Or whatever your thing is that you're caught up with. So there has to be some turning the attention backwards, inward, for the meditation process in a sense. Another way of saying this is, what's the subjective sense, experience, of what's happening in the present moment for me? How is it subjectively to be someone planning what I'm going to do next April? You're caught up in April thoughts. Subjective, what's that like in the moment? So turn into the subjective world. Subjectively, what it's like to be with the breath. Feeling the breath, feeling each breathing. Objectively, it might be all kinds of thoughts about the breath and the right breath and the wrong breath and judging the breath and all that. But rather what you do is drop down and just feel subjectively the inner world. So one of the first principles of mindfulness meditation is a kind of turning away from the world. But as those words come out of my mouth, it sounds like a terrible thing to say. But at least I think some people react negatively, turn away from the world. Maybe it's a better way of saying it. But there has to be a willingness or very clear intent, very clear recognition that what we're doing is we're not going to pursue our thoughts about our problems and our concerns and our fantasies. But we're going to turn back into this inner world and explore it. Get to know it. Settle it. We can use the breathing as a place to encourage that to happen. Develop a stability to stay there. The other thing that's happening, so that's one important principle, turning away from the world. The other important principle is there's the object of what you're paying attention to. And there's also the attention itself and the associated factors that play into attention that support it. So if you're following the breath, you can follow it very intently. And you can get absorbed in the breath and not know anything else. But as you're staying with the breath, a lot of other factors are also, mental factors are also involved in that attention to the breath. One-pointedness, interest, investigation, calmness, tranquility, equanimity, motivation, energy, effort. There's a lot of other elements that come into play. And as you're staying with the breath, for example, it can be useful to track some of these other elements of what's supportive of the process of being with the breath, or whatever you're paying attention to in mindfulness. Am I making sense? So that was, not so much? Oh, well. So that's what I was trying to do during that guided meditation, was to give you a sense of beginning to explore some of the various elements that go on in your mind, in your inner life, when you're being with the breath. What happens? For example, clarity. You can be with your breath, and you can be with your breath quite kind of vaguely, and you can be with the breath very, very clearly. You can be with the breath with great interest, and you can be with the breath with resistance. You can be with your breath with joy, and you can be with discontent. You can be with the breath with real sensitivity to what it feels like in the body. And you can be with the breath kind of in the distance, kind of like you're looking down on it, kind of detached in an unhealthy way, kind of aloof from it, kind of like this thing down there that you're not really connected to. You can be with the breath and be agitated. You can be with the breath and be calm. There's all these different associated factors that can come into play when you're with the breath. And it can be helpful to start noticing these other elements that are happening in your meditation practice. For no other reason, it can help you become interested in that what's happening in your inner life, to find it interesting. And real interest, if you're really deeply interested, will quiet the mind. You'll forget about all these things in the world, all your concerns and preoccupations, and just your mind will get so intent and involved with what is this experience like right now? What is it? What's happening now? So tracking, finding out what's going on. And then as you're staying with the breath or staying in your mindfulness practice, what is it that makes it difficult for you to stay present in the present moment? What is it that takes you away? What concerns? What are the hindrances that come into play? Is it desire, thoughts, motivations of desire, wanting something? That's the Velcro. That's where the mind kind of slips off. Rather than staying on the breath, it has a strong tendency to slip off into desire. To really see that, to be interested, curious, what's that process like? What's that going on in the inner life? Oh, it's desire. How strong is that desire? How do we work with it? What do you do when desire arises? Aversion. What's traditionally called sloth and torpor. Or what's sometimes called restlessness and agitation, anxiety, or doubt, the five hindrances. To be able to track how those work in you without judging and self-criticism and despair about the presence of these things, but with a great fascination, really fascinating, what is it like in your mind? What happens in your mind that makes it difficult for you to be awake and clear and present? Now, the paradox of exploring that is that that very thing will make you very present. As you're very curious, you're interested, what's going on now? The art, part of the art of doing all this, tracking or sensing or being present for this inner world, is can you do it in a way where you're kind of listening with a silent mind? Can you listen, kind of like, can you be very intently present, sensing or feeling or listening? So actually the mind gets quieter in the process of doing that. Rather than a discursive kind of thinking it out and wondering and, you know, is it this or is it that or what's going on, and the mind gets more and more busy. But rather it's sensing or feeling or hearing what's actually going on here with greater clarity. Is that making some sense now? A little bit? What was that meditation like for some of you, that guided meditation? Yes?
I kept falling asleep until I heard your voice. And then I come back.
So it's important to notice that, for sure. But you want to find some way to stay awake.
I meditated a different hour of the day.
That can be one thing. But also it's very interesting then, when you're sitting here and you're feeling sleepy, what are the factors that cultivate greater clarity and wakefulness? And there are different things that can cultivate that and develop that. And one of the things is that you don't want to do meditation as a relaxation technique, which a lot of people have a strong association to meditation is about becoming calm. Calm is only one factor that needs to be there. And if you're already sleepy, don't try to make yourself more calm. Rather, cultivate the arousing factors. Cultivate greater clarity.
So I investigate.
That's one way.
Yeah.
More effort. Someone else.
I found that I got very concentrated almost immediately. Was able to sort of quiet myself as I'm able to do sometimes. And I found the guidance and a slight intrusion kind of pulled me away from the breath and sort of being. And so if I had a difficulty getting around that, it's like kind of like, well, that's another thing that's happening.
Okay, great. Someone else? Yes?
I found myself kind of polarized between focusing on the breath and then a thought would take me out to thinking about the world. And then I would catch that and come back to the breath and go back and forth and back and forth. And then occasionally I would start to notice changes in my body. Like my shoulders feel better, my breathing is smoother or not smoother. But I wanted to be able to stay with what I was sensing in my body more. But it was more like polarization between thought, breath, thought, breath. I was trying to be more present to the feeling, but that was hard to do.
Okay. So that's one of the things we can track and be aware of over time, is the varying degrees in which it's easy or difficult to stay present to a feeling or the breath or anything. And to start getting a sense of the variations and differences is another way of getting interested, staying interested. Today I'm not so present. What's that like? What does that feel like? Oh, and sense that and explore that. And then the mind gets kind of involved or engrossed or sensitive, interested, or is quiet around, you know, that. Well, today it's very, you know, I'm very attentive, I mean, very clear and very present. And so you have greater interest. What's that like? You know, and just kind of explore that and feel that. So whatever your experience is, to feel that there's an inner world you can be exploring. So, I mean, one of the reasons to have this class is built on the introductory class. In the introductory class, I mean, not that you can do it just from taking the intro class, is to learn to just let your experience be as it is and not judge or criticize or evaluate or want it to be different. You know, but having that ability to just be very self-accepting makes it a lot easier then to go into this world and begin noticing the variations and differences and how things change over time and not get tripped up by it, by judging it or saying, oh no, I'm not so concentrated today. Oh, that's terrible and I hope no one notices. As opposed, that's being caught up by the world again. As opposed to, oh, I'm not so concentrated today. Great. I get to experience what it's like for a human being to be not concentrated. What's this like? So we want to turn away from worldly concerns to really sensing what's that inner process actually like in and of itself. And seeing the variations over time can be one of the things that pulls you in to become greater, more interested. I don't know if that addresses your... Holly.
Oh. I kept being really glad when you'd tell us to do something, because then I didn't have to tell myself to do it. It seemed like I'm continually saying, I'll do this, do that. But then you sort of took the burden off and said, now step up your motivation this time. Now really get going here. I thought, oh, yeah, good. No. Then I noticed there was some little person in the background that said, lazy, don't do that.
So both those things you can investigate. So if there's these voices inside of you that are telling you what to do, directing the show all the time, go explore that. Be interested. What's that like? What's that voice like? What's the tension, if there is, or pressure within you that is part of that voice? And what's the agitation that maybe is part of it? And if you can explore that, maybe it can quiet down. And then you can continue practicing, but without the agitation of kind of a little director who's directing the show. Or if you feel a kind of laziness come on, then go and explore that. What's the laziness like? Oh, what's that moment? What's that like in the present moment to be lazy? What's laziness is getting in the way of being really clear and present here. What's going on? What's that like? And explore that. So there's this whole inner ecology to be explored, and there's fascinating. I mean, it's a huge universe. We turn away from the world so we can discover the universe. It's just this huge, you know, phenomenal thing to discover. And if you take interest in it and begin exploring, I think that meditation will become much more alive for you, much more interesting. This can be somewhat disappointing to some of you to hear if you have a very strong association that what meditation is about is relaxation. That's one thing it can be about. It's a very useful part of meditation. But meditation goes way beyond just becoming relaxed. And in fact, relaxation is a dead end.
Before the meditation and even after the meditation, my world was one of very much fatigue, drowsiness. And then when I started the meditation, then I developed a tremendous amount of energy, almost rising to the ceiling, it felt like, and a lot of clarity, and a lot of my mind was just very open. So.
Great.
It was just the opposite. Well, listening to you at this time of the night, I'm sorry, you're very interesting, but tonight it wasn't my cup of tea. But the meditation was just really good for me.
So what about the rest of you? Do you see variations in your degree of clarity over the course of the meditation? Greater and less? It's going to vary. Different people did. Yeah? So that's something you can track. And tracking that, being attentive to it, is part of what keeps you can keep you engaged in the meditation. But be careful you're not using that material, what you're learning, to be further reasoned to have worldly concerns about judging yourself negatively or positively, whatever it might be. But rather to help you entering into this inner world of stillness. So, yes?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the things that maybe I struggle with is the level of effort of investigation sometimes leads into trying to direct the experience. Like when you're describing the feeling, the sensation of the shoulders, was immediately associated with, I'm supposed to be feeling something in my shoulders. And there's kind of almost a manufacturing of an experience. So I'm not quite sure how to go with that. But I mean, for me, it seems like there's a time when the investigation, there's some allowing in the investigation. If I try too hard to investigate, it becomes kind of directing or fabricating an experience. If that makes sense.
It could make sense. I mean, it could also not. I'm not sure.
Well, let me say this. I really didn't want to pay attention to my shoulders. I really felt a real deep sadness that has been coming up, you know, all day. And it felt like it was calling to be witnessed and not perhaps investigated on my terms, but wanting to just be seen.
Sure.
So that's what I mean about like investigating. It was like trying to like go at it. Somehow doesn't. Finding the right level of investigation seemed necessary.
Sure. Yeah. And this is why I think it's useful to have understand there can be a wide variety of ways of being present for ourselves mindfully, depending on what's happening. And sometimes You know, if there's a lot of sadness or grief, for example, sometimes the best thing to do is get out of our own way and just let it be there and not try to be so actively involved. There's a time for a more receptive, very receptive aspect of meditation, and there's a time for a more active aspect of meditation. And we're kind of constantly negotiating back and forth between being receptive and active in our practice. We'll talk more about that next week. And it's not just being passive, but we have to know when to do different things. And when the two, ideally the two are completely balanced. So and when they're completely balanced, they have kind of a receptivity plus an activity together, then it can feel very, very dynamic and alive and alert and very clear. It's kind of like, I mean, this feeling I have sometimes when I'm really very, very much in the present moment, just really there. It feels like I've caught a wave, I'm surfing. And the present moment is like, the present is like a wave, and I'm on that wave. And being on that wave, surfing, is a very dynamic activity. But it's also, you know, very still, or very, you know, it's kind of like timeless. It's kind of this amazing, you know, wonderful thing. You know, standing on a surfboard, you can't be really, I don't think you can be really tense on a surfboard, because then you probably fall in. But it's kind of like you're, you know, it's a very dynamic balance between alertness and relaxation. I don't know if this at all addresses your concern, but we should stop, I think.
I have a quick question about the journal.
Yes.
Since it's a 45 minutes experience, we can write for a long time about every part of it. So like a little bit of guidance as to what are we supposed to write about.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so what I want to give, for the first week, I actually have this handout for you. And I did 50 copies, and I think it's somewhere roughly about 50 people here. So if there are people here who know that they can easily share, you might just take one and make a Xerox for yourself. And what I'd like to do is for you to, some of these factors we talked about in the meditation today, I don't want you so much to be, you can be tracking them as you wish. But what I particularly want you to do is at the end of the meditation is to jot down with this grid, this table here, the degree to the presence of absence of these things in your meditation on a scale of 1 to 10. So you have to figure out what that means. Scale of 1 to 10 is, you know, that's, I think it's very personal criteria. I don't know just how it is for you. You know, so calmness, scale of 1 to 10, how were you? You know, if this was the most calm you've ever been, maybe you give it a 9.5, assuming that you can always get more. But, you know, maybe, you know, this is half as calm as you know you can be, so you give it a, I don't know what. So there's a different calmness, alertness, the strength of your preoccupation. That's fascinating, right? So how strong is your preoccupations? How strong was your ability to let go of your preoccupations, of your thoughts? How strong was your motivation in the practice? The motivation to be present, the motivation to let go. How strong is motivation? What was the degree of enjoyment that you had, in any kind of form of enjoyment, in the process of meditation itself? The degree of sensitivity to your body, the degree of concentration, the degree of effort that you're applying, and the degree to which your thinking mind became quiet in the course of the sitting. And so I want you to kind of, each meditation, to write down this. And in doing this each day of the week, next week, maybe get a sense of how this varies from day to day. And my hope is in doing that, you become more sensitive to things that you might not have paid much attention to. If you just kind of living each meditation as kind of like it's a thing in and of itself. Sometimes we don't see patterns over time unless we somehow have a record to look back on and say, I didn't know that it was like that. The second thing I'd like you to do is, and there's some more instructions around that here, and the second thing I would like you to pay careful attention to the hindrances. I hope that all of you know what the five hindrances are. If you're not, you might get a basic book on mindfulness meditation. And almost every book will have a discussion about the five hindrances. And And do the same thing for those from a scale of 1 to 10. How strong was these particular things in your meditation? And sometimes I know you might feel like you want to give a 10 to every single one. But, you know, you figure out, you know. And again, that tracking what's really going on, getting a better sense of which hindrances are most common for you. So you get over the week, you start noticing, oh, it seems like it's really common for me to have desire. I hardly ever, you know, in terms of aversion, it always has a 1 or 2, but desire is like 9 all the time. And you might not notice the patterns of the kind of hindrances that are most commonly appear for you, unless you kind of jot it down in this simple way. And then there's some more instructions of what to write about the hindrances here at the end of this. So my vision, my idea is that this is not going to take you more than, you know, 10, 15 minutes to do this. It can be a very simple kind of notation kind of style. So that's what I have for you. And so hopefully you'll find this useful for all of you. And hopefully today was useful. My evaluation was that it didn't seem like it, you know, it seemed like I had a lot I wanted to say and I didn't really organize it so well or explain it so well. But that's kind of the price of doing something for the first time and being tired. So hopefully, you know, I can be more succinct or organized or clear next week in what I'm going to talk about. And so thank you all very much.